Well, I'm thrilled to get to introduce Laura for the second time on her little book tour with this book. As a kid, I had the honor of growing up with Laura as one of the large female figures in my life. And I remember, I have fond memories of peering around hallway corners listening to her and the other women in my mother's book club with their incredible insights on literature. And so it's a real honor to get to introduce her today. I also have very fond memories of attending lots of her award-winning plays over the years. She's an incredible writer, an award-winning playwright, librettist, and lyricist. She's a 2-time winner of the Massachusetts Cultural Council Award in playwriting and Clodder Competition for Best New Play in New England. She currently teaches at MIT and has been for 30 years now, almost, where she was awarded the 2009 Levitin Prize for Excellence in Teaching. Her first book, Alice Bliss, had national appeal and won the 2012 Massachusetts Book Award. I'm thrilled to have Laura Harrington here. Please welcome her.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Laura.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, everybody, for being here. What a lovely group. I was thinking as I drove over, is there anyone in Gloucester who hasn't heard me read yet? Because you've all been so absolutely amazing about supporting me and this book, and I'm very, very grateful. It's been a lot of fun. I've only been at MIT for 26 years. It seems like a long time when you say it like that. And when you say 30, it seems like, holy moly, might be time to do something else. So if I stand here, is that right? Lovely. Hello, everyone. Do I have a lot of writers in this group, possibly? Can I see a show of hands? Oh my goodness, that's a little intimidating.
I just wrote doggerel.
Oh no, that's not true. That's not true. I thought tonight I'd talk a little bit about my inspiration for this book, and then do reading and leave ample time for a couple of questions or lots of questions. I'm happy to talk about writing books, writing plays, writing musicals, anything that it might be of interest. So this book started several years ago for me when I became pretty upset about the fact that we're losing almost a soldier an hour to suicide. And it's something like 23 soldiers a day are committing suicide. And that's a hard number for me to live with, to think about, to imagine, to wrap my arms around. And I'm also incredibly upset over the fact that we are engaged in what I can only call forever wars, 16 years in, and most of us have the luxury to not pay attention. So, and I think that's pretty dangerous for our democracy to have 1% of our population bearing the costs and the consequences of these conflicts. And our not paying attention means we don't know what's being done in our name. And whatever it is that's being done in our name is apparently so morally confusing and soul damaging that we are losing a lot of soldiers to suicide. So not to be too heavy, but that's where the book began for me in being a citizen in this world and thinking about war, how war is happening now, what is happening to our soldiers. And then what I've learned over time is that the darker the subject you want to write about, the more worthwhile you have to make it for your audience. War in particular is something that if most of us are capable of ignoring the fact that it's happening, we're also kind of feeling like, oh, I'm not really sure I want to read that story. So how are you going to craft a narrative around that encompasses these concerns, these ideas, but that allows the reader in, invites the reader in, and makes it a story that someone really wants to read and embrace and have it be part of their lives? So I solved that problem in Alice Bliss. my first novel, which was about a family. It's a coming-of-age story. It's about a girl whose dad is in the reserves, and as you may remember, in 2008, we began to throw our reservists into active duty. And that book tells the story both of Alice's growing up, it's a coming-of-age story, against the background of her father going missing in Iraq. So it's really telling the story of what war is like for the families and the children who are left behind. And because the surface of that story is about a kid, and the surface of that story is about coming of age, it's very easy to invite the reader into that story. And so it's a deeper story about the war and our responsibility, etc., is something that comes along for the ride, in a sense. So I had to think about this pretty seriously as I was imagining writing a catalog of birds as well. And by complete serendipity, a close friend gave me a book that she bought at the bookstore called Of Wolves and Honey, The Hidden History of the Natural World, which was a memoir about a brother and a sister. The two main characters in my new book are a brother and a sister, set on Seneca Lake in Geneva, New York, which is about 50 miles from where I grew up, and I had never been there. My family went camping in Maine or camping on Lake Ontario, but we did not go to the Finger Lakes. I guess there were sort of two parties in Rochester. You went to the Finger Lakes or you went north. And they were both naturalists, and that the evocation of the natural world that occurred in that book was just profound. It was one of the most beautiful books I've ever read about the natural world, both in terms of birds and hunting and the lake, and the closeness to that world, the sensitivity to that world, and the ability of the natural world to heal us. Mm-hmm. So then I began to think about a brother and a sister, and setting my story on Seneca Lake, and setting my character's big Irish Catholic family in a tumble-down house right on the lake. And one of the most interesting things that I learned, again, as part of this hidden history, that Seneca Lake is named after Seneca Indians. And the Seneca Indians were part of the Five Nation Confederacy. Is that right? Do I have the right word? The Confederation of Nations. That and some of them opposed the U.S. in their war against Britain in the Revolutionary War. And in 1779, Washington sent Sullivan and the remnants of the Revolutionary Army to the western frontier, which at that time was the Finger Lakes of western New York, and to punish the Seneca Indians for their loyalty to the British. And the journals of Sullivan's army are absolutely beautiful documents, and the men write in awe of the beauty that they found on Seneca Lake, that it was the most fertile, beautiful, fruit-growing land that they had ever seen. And they, expecting to encounter savages, they instead found the longhouses, which they described as castles made of wood, and the most beautiful fields of apples, peaches, pears, and plums. And so they came and burned the longhouses to the ground and cut every tree to the ground and burned them all and burned 200,000 bushels of corn and drove the Seneca off to Fort Niagara, where they perished in a very brutally cold winter. So that is a big part of our history, and I realized that I didn't really want to write another book about Iraq, and that I was still incredibly haunted by my own family's experiences in Vietnam, experiences that continue to resonate through the years. So I decided I would set my book during the Vietnam era, and then I realized that one of the things that's parallel between Vietnam and our own history, our sense of our exceptional selves as we discovered America, is that we also destroyed an entire native population. And that how was that similar to what we were able to do in Vietnam by defining the Vietnamese as very other from ourselves, as you've heard all of the slurs that were visited upon the Vietnamese people. And finally, I got incredibly interested in the apples of the region. I happen to have a book that I probably didn't save enough of my parents' library, but one of the books I saved was my mother's, and it is a 2-volume book. It's published in like 1898 of The Apples of New York State, and each volume is the size of a phone book. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of extraordinary to imagine we needed 1,500 pages, 2,000 pages to talk about the apples of New York State, what the richness of that culture was at the time. And lo and behold, there's a black and white plate in the middle of this book which shows us one of the Seneca Indian trees. There's still a stump with a green shoot coming out of it. So those were many of the elements of my story. The dad is a pomologist at the Cornell Agricultural Station, which is built upon the Seneca Indian land. And the work that he's doing, along with his research, is trying to bring back the Seneca apples, one of the strains of the Seneca apples. And so now I want to write about a brother and a sister. And I've got my place, and I've got my big Irish Catholic family, and Dad's a pomologist, and I know my main character, Billy, is going to be a helicopter pilot, so I decide to make him a bird artist so that I can embed him in the natural landscape in very, very deep and telling ways, and so that beauty and that sort of sense of lift that he has, because he would rather fly than do anything else in the world, is also something that occurs for the reader, right, as we are woven through the book with birds and Billy's experience of birds. But you can't write about a generic bird artist, and I am not a bird artist. I'm not a birder. I love birds. So I fell in love with a bird artist named Matt Adrian. And because I have written in the theater for so long, I'm used to collaborating with people, so I didn't think twice about calling him and saying, "Hi, you don't know me, but I would like to use your work as the basis of my character's work in my book." And the other cool thing that Matt Adrian does is he captions his paintings. And some of them are very funny. He's a very funny guy, and some of them are incredibly touching. I'll leave this up at the front afterwards. I'm not going to pass around, or you'll be so distracted you won't listen to me. But here's one of the paintings that I reference in the book, and the title of this is "Had I But Hands to Put Around Your Throat." And then another key painting is this one of the great blue heron, which plays a large role in the book. So, pardon? Yeah.
And where is he from?
He lives in California. Like all writers, you know, I turn to books. And then, and my daughter gave me this book for Christmas several years ago. So it was, again, serendipity. And for the writers in the room, I'm sure you've experienced this, that when you're embarking on a project, suddenly it seems as though everything around you is part of the circle of ideas. And everything you touch and see then is feeding you in some pretty significant ways. So I walk into the wonderful Sawyer Free Library one day, and they have this book on display, which is called America's Other Audubon. And this is about a young woman who went to the World's Fair in the late 1800s and saw Audubon's paintings. And she was so struck by their beauty. But she came home and said to her brother, again, we have a brother-sister story here, and her parents, why doesn't he paint their nests and their eggs? How can we understand birds if we don't understand their nests and their eggs? So she and her brother set out to create a book that would be hand-colored plates of all of the, they lived in Ohio, of all of the birds that and nests that they could find. And then she died before they finished the project. And her mother learned to draw so that her family could finish the project in her memory. Her father was a doctor. They went nearly bankrupt to create the book, because at the time it was very, very expensive to create. They couldn't get enough subscriptions to pay for it. And the reason we have this book is that an archivist or a researcher was looking at an archive in Ohio and stumbled upon one of the only editions that they have. Mm-hmm. And she brought the story back with these drawings to us. Here is an example of the wood thrush. And for me, as I was starting to understand how naturalists function in the world and how they do their research and respond to what they see, this writing just popped right out at me. Okay, so we're in the 1890s. And these are, she started this when she was in her teens, all right? She says, though the wood thrush is naturally shy, she rarely abandons her nest on account of intrusion, being repeatedly driven from it. She as often returns as soon as the danger is past. I found that the writing and the depth of observation in this book, as with other field journals that I got my hands on, was just extraordinary. Here we go. Here's another one. Good. And this is the Wilson's thrush, and she says, the bird is naturally shy and usually avoids man, but instances are recorded where it has made its home in a country garden and even in a city lawn. And you'll see that they've shown you the tree that they found the nest in. Here is a description of exactly where it was and what it's made of. Some of these nests are made of snake skin. And then later in the book are these, well, these...
And human hair?
Human hair, yep. Where are my eggs? Come on. Here we go. That's the key to the eggs. Here we go. Mm. Mm. And these are to scale. Yeah. So it's just kind of a delight, right? And really helped take me inside my naturalists, my brother and sister, who were in love with and hoped to be healed by the natural world and hoped to save it. Because at the same time, this is also the period of time when Rachel Carson has just published Silent Spring. And as you may know, war is the largest polluter man has ever invented. And the chemicals that we use in warfare come home and get named something else. Agent Orange becomes Roundup. And the book takes place in 1970, and at that time we only had 400 pair of eagle left in the entire country. And because of DDT and other chemicals in our whole ecosystem, which Rachel Carson was fundamental in helping us to understand what that even was, birds were unable to sit on their nests. If they did, their eggs were fragile and cracked. So we were seeing a decimation of the world that sustains us, as well as imposing that on another country, Vietnam, through our use of untold amounts, hundreds of thousands of tons of what they call the rainbow chemicals, agents, red, yellow, orange, and I think there's another. So that, too, is part of my story, because many soldiers have come home and are coming home from Iraq, where we are doing the same thing, with serious illnesses, which they are then asked to prove to the government how that illness occurred, rather than the government taking responsibility for sending them into not just harm's way, but into poison. So those are some of the big themes of the book. And I thought I would read two passages for you. One I have never read before, so I'm looking forward to that. And I thought I would read first a brief passage, Billy and Nell. Billy enlists when he's the minute he turns 18 and graduates from high school, and he is the sole survivor of a helicopter crash. His younger sister, Nell, is 17 at the time the book happens. The book really takes place from the time Billy gets home from Vietnam. He's been terribly burned, et cetera, and he was on a hospital ship in the South China Sea for a period of time before he could come home. And Nell is just about to graduate from high school, and the book spans a spring and the beginning of a summer. And Nell is a budding scientist, and she wants to go to Cornell, and she's been studying with one of the ornithologists at Cornell, who is a friend of her brother's. But this day, she arrives home and finds a letter from Cornell in the mailbox. opening it, she allows herself to hope that the thickness of the envelope means good news. She scans the letter as fast as she can, "We welcome you to the class of 1974, and skips to the last paragraph. "We are pleased to offer you a scholarship in the amount of ... which, in addition to your Regents scholarship, will cover your tuition." Her family moved, her parents moved Billy out of the VA hospital, where the care was, as you probably know, at that time subpar, and put him into a private hospital, and his care has almost bankrupted them. And whatever money they had saved for Nell to go to college has been spent on Billy's hospitalization. So this thing about money and a scholarship is a big deal for her. Maybe it's a mistake, she thinks. Maybe there will be a call and they'll take it back. She looks at the envelope again. Yes, it is addressed to her. Reading the letter, she allows herself to feel a rush of excitement. She wants to tell someone. A year ago, she would have picked up the phone and called Megan. Megan is her childhood best friend and Billy's girlfriend who has disappeared. She wonders if Megan's letters are sitting in the Alsop mailbox, acceptances, rejections, offers of financial aid. She calls out to Billy. No answer, though Flanagan appears at the back door. She lets the dog out, then charges up the stairs to see if maybe, just maybe, Billy is home. When she knocks, the door falls open. The curtains are drawn, the bed unmade. There are beer bottles on the floor and under the bed, overflowing ashtrays. The desk is buried under a pile of clothes, his discarded duffel stuffed underneath. All of his paintings are gone, and all of his drawings have been torn from the corkboard. In some places, the board had been thick with paper, study after study, an individual bird emerging, finally, like magic, on the page. Now the wall holds images torn from newspapers, from magazines, all of them, she realizes, a variation on a theme, the jungle on fire. Shot from above, helicopters caught inside the frame, shot from the ground, villagers or soldiers running, the fire pouring toward them. Fire and smoke rolling over fields and forests, the suggestive beauty and the scathing ruin. Another group of photos, birds, impossibly on fire and in flight, some falling from the sky. Helicopters at the moment of crashing, a pelican skeleton stretched over a huge rock. The first x-rays of Billy's hand and arm and torso, the shrapnel, even here, glinting like knives. In a panic, she searches the floor under the bed, thinking something can be salvaged, inventories the paintings she has in her possession, the great horned owl in her room, the eastern phoebe inside her closet door, the mourning doves in her locker at school, the small canvas at the piano downstairs, turns to the wall beside Billy's bed. The great blue heron is gone. She looks to the bookshelf. At least his field journals are still here, she sees with relief, dozens of them filling the shelves, thinks of moving them to her own room for safekeeping. And then she smells smoke. Pushing the curtains open, she looks out to the side yard. Billy stands with his back to her, a trash barrel burning in front of him, feeding his drawings and paintings into the fire. She sees the grackles, shiny blue-black feathers, facing away from the viewer, looking over its shoulder, consumed in the flames. Feels the caption Billy had written rising up in her, "Had I but hands to put around your throat." She lifts a hand to knock at the window, yell through the glass, knows it's too late. His hands are nearly empty, the fire blazing. He looks over his shoulder, up to the window, sensing her presence, unconsciously mimicking the bird. His eyes are blank. Yeah. Sorry, it's not too funny. I'd love to read you a funny passage, but that would be hard to find, I think. Maybe one of the weaknesses of the book. I'm going to read you a moment near the end of the book. I've never had a chance to read this to anyone before. Nell's graduation has just happened, and Marion, who is the mother, has said to her husband, Jack, "I want them all home." get them all home. I want to see all my kids. So one thing I'm asking you, get them home for Nell's graduation. So Jack has done this for Nell, for the family. As the sun sets, Jack and Nick, his son-in-law, gather wood, Connor and Colin, his grandchildren, trailing them. Jack is their father, Nell and Billy's father. They scrape the old grill rack and set it on stones over the fire. While Rosie feeds the baby, Rosie's the oldest daughter, Marion, the mom, Sheila, the other sister, and Nell, our main character, carry down platters and plates, cups and cutlery. There is too much food. When making her list, Marion could only add, never subtract, and so they have hamburgers, red and white hots, potato salad, macaroni salad, coleslaw, baked beans, deviled eggs, radishes, and lettuce salad, lemonade, milk, and iced coffee. They can barely find room on the picnic tables Nell decorated with red gingham cloths and wildflowers in jelly jars. When it doesn't seem possible anyone could eat another mouthful, Marion carries the strawberry shortcake down the hill, piled high with whipped cream. The boys clamor for bowls of it, not just those dinky little dessert plates. Jack passes out the sparklers he drove into Canada to buy, dozens of them, more than they'd ever had for the 4th of July. Connor and Colin run and twirl with the sparklers, streaks of light up and down the path, in and out of the trees. There are graduation gifts. Nell is embarrassed by all the attention. Wearing the gown and crossing the stage was more than enough spotlight. Megan had not even been mentioned at the ceremony, although what could be said? The cruelty of not knowing what has happened to her silences them all. Her absence is like a stitch in Nell's side, a missing rib. As Nell crossed the stage, she looked up to see Megan's father, Asa Alsop, standing at the back of the auditorium. He'd raised his hand to her, a salute. Who else thought of Megan that day, remembered her, turned to each other to ask, did they ever find that girl? Reduced now to that girl, fading from view, mind, memory, not for Billy, she knows, not for her family. Jack and Marion make toasts with lemonade until Brendan reveals the stash of beer. Even Sheila has a bottle. Jack throws more wood on the fire, sparks scatter into the sky. Give us a song, Sheila, Brendan asks. No, no way, she says. Come on, Brendan insists. Connor sits beside his grandfather. Colin claims his father's lap. Sheila, embarrassed, clears her throat. Quit stalling, Brendan teases. I've met some folks who say that I'm a dreamer, and I've no doubt there's truth in what they say. Jack joins Sheila. Nell looks at him, surprised. It's so rare now. Her father is shy of his voice, though anyone would tell you it's a beautiful voice, high and sweet. Billy leaves the table, walks out to the end of the dock, and lies down, Flanagan at his feet. Nell watches him go. She can see how spent he is, feel the undercurrent of agitation, how often he needs to shut down and withdraw. Marion notices Billy leave as well, tries not to read too much into it. This is probably where I'm starting to wrap it up, Henry, if you wanted to know that. Nell follows her brother, lies down next to him, her head on his shoulder. You okay? She asks. Tired is all. She waits for him to tell her more, or the truth, or anything at all. She looks across the lake, feeling the weight of Billy's sadness, the darkness that sometimes engulfs him. Thinks of Harlow's distance, Billy's best friend, and wonders if the two are related. Will you sing to me, Nell? He asks, turning to look at her. After those two? He nods, holding her gaze. She's unsteady as she begins, her voice catching in her throat. She sings softly, hardly more than a whisper. Oh, if I were a blackbird, could whistle and sing, I'd follow the vessel my true love sails in. And in that dark rigging, I'd there build my nest and flutter my wings o'er her lily-white breast. Nell sings all the verses for Billy while Sheila lights the candles, full dark falling down on them through the pine trees. Nell imagines soaring like a blackbird. From high above, she would see the candles shining on the table, the smoke from the fire curling into the sky. higher still, and she would see the kitchen lights from the old camps and small cottages around the lake, a few blinking dock lights, the warm windows where families eat dinner, talk about the weather, plan tomorrows. Higher still, and she would see all 10 of the Finger Lakes, surrounded by thousands of acres of forest and farmland. If she could see her family running down through time into their future, what would she see? Can she guess their hopes and their fears? Can she imagine Rosie's boys grown, Billy fully healed, all of them living out their days and their years? Will they be so lucky? Thank you.
Thank you so much.